Welcome to the first days of 2023. It's the last time to take a brief look in the rearview mirror and reflect on the memorable moments and events of the past year. I wanted to take a moment to appreciate all the amazing conversations on my podcast over the last 12 months. From global crisis to personal triumphs and failures, 2022 has been a year like definitely no other. I covered various topics on the show, from venture capital to clinical development, psychedelics, virtual reality, and also biophysics. In honor of all these incredible episodes, I'm indulging in a new annual tradition and starting the new year with a compilation of the best excerpts from the previous 12 months. Since I had so many fantastic speakers in over 37 podcast episodes, it was difficult for me to select just five standout conversations from the many that I've had. So this was the reason why I enlisted the help of artificial intelligence. And since ChatGPT started November 30, 2022, I thought it's a good idea to ask the AI to randomly generate five numbers between 60, the first episode of 2022, and 97, the last episode of 2022. And here in this podcast and also video on YouTube, you get the five episodes that ChatGPT has selected. And I've chosen to highlight. As we enter the new year, it's also a time to look ahead and plan for what lies ahead. So at the end of this video and podcast, you will get some information about what I want to achieve with the podcast in 2023. In the words of the great C.S. Lewis, the future is something which everyone reaches at the rate of 60 minutes an hour, whatever they do, whoever they are. So grab your holiday cheer, join me as I reflect on the past year's highlights and look ahead to what's in the store in the new year. The clock is ticking and the future is waiting for us. Here is the first episode with valuable insights from a venture capital insider. In this episode of the Beginner's Mind podcast, I delve into the strategic role of venture capital in fostering innovation and driving success in the life sciences industry. My guest in this episode was Bruno Montanari. He is a seasoned expert in the field with a background in venture capital and investment banking and a focus on the pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and medical device sectors. Through our conversation, we unravel the secrets of venture capital and explore how it supports the growth of early stage startups. Bruno shares valuable insights on the importance of gathering information before closing deals and the role of venture capital firms in supporting their portfolio companies. We also discuss the entrepreneurship mindset between academia and industry and the current state of European venture capital. Whether you're seeking to master the art of investing in life science companies or simply want better to understand the inner workings of the pharma industry, this episode is a must listen. I like fairy tales, and the great thing with fairy tales is that it's nice storytelling. Yeah. And it's very engaging. You have the ups and downs and characters who evolve and need to go to failures together. And at the end of the day, mostly a prince and a princess marry, and then the end of the story is, and they lived happily ever after, and nobody ever told how this happily ever after looked like. Can you shine a little bit of light how the happily ever after looks like with a VC once the deal is closed? Is it that way that the VC just walks away and says, okay, I deployed my money and that's it for me, and I don't have any more questions?
No, actually, you might think as well in terms of the storytelling, who will kiss the frog to become a prince, okay? Is it the VC having to kiss founders and managers, or the managers having to kiss the VCs, which might be frogs or toads, okay? But this is maybe for another day. No, of course, it's just, I mean, signing the legal documentation for first fundraising is only the beginning of the story, okay? Mm-hmm. Now we're talking real. Now we're talking about execution, and we're talking about how good of a match we will be together at the governance level to make sure we can help and build together this great opportunity. And this is where expectations will be met or fail, clearly. So it's the beginning of a journey. But again, if things have been done hastily, without the right question asked, without the right analysis done, well, you are bound to have surprises, and probably nasty surprises. If everyone has done a proper work at knowing each other, at understanding the business, at aligning visions, it will go better. It's not to say that there will not be tough times, because again, inevitably, this is the life of the startups, okay? It's very rare that a plan is being executed as expected, okay, without hiccups, without competition emerging, without data which are not the one we expected, without people leaving the company to go to whoever and having to be replaced. And mm-hmm. Yes, all of this happens. All of this happens. But it's again, it's all about anticipation, and it's the time spent before the signing of the legals for fundraising that probably will direct the track into which you will embark for this journey. Very important. And sometimes you see things coming from far away. You want people, but you say, you know what? There's no ideal deals. So let's get to work on it. Let's sign this fundraising and we'll figure out. And there's a bit of that as well. You know, you mm-hmm. don't know exactly how it will fare. And for me, this is the excitement as well. I mean, if everything was a stepwise process already cooked and digested ahead, I think I would be so bored. I would have done something else of my life. I mean, I like the fact that we have to renew our thinking. We have to be always open-minded to look at what's going on in the field, in the areas, sometimes in very different areas, to be able to feed into the technologies and the programs, to hear very interesting people that we want to add at the governance into the management. I mean, it's great, actually. But you have to adapt. You have to adapt, and you have to have a strong heart and strong guts as well, not to say anything about any other part of our anatomy. Alors, there are various reasons. I would say that the best reason, and you will understand why I say the best reason, is when, after trying to really understand the biology and making a bet that your new drug or new devices will address a given pathway or target or mechanism of action that you really believe into it. Well, actually, biology will bring some new features to this original hypothesis. And you will figure out over time that actually not all patients obviously are the same, will react the same. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, if the investment hypothesis around biology is not proven, well, so be it. But the important thing is that at the origin, your investment thesis was sound, backed by experts, key opinion leaders that really believed into it. But the proof is in the pudding. I mean, we're talking about innovation. So it's not that you can look back and say, oh, it worked before, so I know that you have all chances that it will work again. Well, actually, no, you don't know. Clearly, unless you are into some incremental innovation to make some things a bit better. But no, we're talking real innovation here, okay? Something that will dramatically change the way patients are being treated or even diagnosed and monitored. And so this is, I would say, one main reason, and I would qualify it as the best reason, failure. Okay. Then you have other reasons. Other reasons can be competition. I mean, to put it simply, today, given the amount of money and new company creations and new ideas generated every day, as soon as you invest into a company, the next day you have competition emerging. Of course, I'm pushing it a bit, but just to say how competitive it became. And it's great at the end of the day because you cannot rest on your laurels, you know, and just have a nice cup of tea every 2 hours and think that, okay, you have time. No, you need to really be focused and up to speed on the program you want to pursue. And so sometimes competition can come up with something that is better. And so you need to reinvent yourself, maybe restart. And this is where partly failures can happen. And then the worst of the failures is about bad execution. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's face it. And bad executions means, unfortunately, a management team which is not up to speed with regard to how to best position a technology or program, not up to speed into the best study design to really prove their case. And sometimes it can come as well from governance. Okay. And it's partly execution as well. And when I mean governance, is that you've got board of directors with very different people there. And sometimes the agendas are not aligned. The vision are not aligned either. And it creates sometimes confusion, lack of decision making, and you can suffer a lot from that as well. So you see, you have a variety of failures, and this is where, but probably we'll speak about that maybe later on, but this is where experience is fundamental, because experience means avoiding mistakes that you've seen and experienced before, but as well, making sure that you've got the right mindset around the table with people that can work together, with whom there is alchemy, because there are going to be inevitably tough times to go through. And we will need to collectively think in the best manner without throwing dirt at each other and without wanting to be absolutely right compared to others, but really raise the right questions, bring the right expertise, open the book of relationship that we have to help, and to go through those tough moments. And so the human aspects of it, for me, is actually critical. Sometimes even more critical than the science and the data, you see. And I have this, this say where you can get it wrong and it's going to be like inverse alchemy. You have gold in the wrong hands and you turn that into lead. So you need to be super careful about the human aspects in any venture at any stage of the development of a company.
Did you know that 90% of product ideas fail in clinical trials? What can sponsors of clinical trials do to increase success? While lack of efficacy is often the main reason for failure, other factors can be managed to increase the probability of success. Clinical trial failures can be costly for sponsors and investors, but taking steps to eliminate manageable sources of failure can help save time and expenses. In this episode, I am talking with Heike Schön from Loomis International and Loomis Consulting. The firms specialize in providing legal and data representation services, regulatory consulting, and customer-tailored consulting and solutions for biopharmaceutical and medical device companies. Heike Schön is the managing director and co-founder of these companies and has over 25 years of experience in leadership positions in international clinical research and drug development, and can provide insight into the clinical trial drug development process, regulatory requirements, and how to manage clinical trials. In this episode of the Beginner's Mind podcast, she discusses strategic considerations for setting up a clinical trial, in-house versus outsourced clinical trial study management, steps to getting a clinical trial back on track, and future trends in this area.
Absolutely. And this brings to another point, which is very important. Good that you mentioned the relationship. It is the relationship, but it's also the understanding the different cultures. I mean, sometimes we have, small biotech companies, the smallest one I worked with had 3 people, and everything was outsourced. And they have a culture, of course, the decision-making process is without discussions. It's just done by the CEO. The CRO themselves were a couple of 100 people. Of course, they had a structure, an organigram. They had very complex decision-making processes. And this can really cause a culture clash because the smaller company was not used to discuss much. And then they suddenly expected decision-making power of people who didn't have any decision-making power. So it's very important for both parties to understand each other's culture and to accept the differences and to work with the differences. And for small companies, you can always consider that the CRO is much bigger and much more complex in the organization than yourself. And so I think then the relationship building is even more important. And but to make sure that you understand each other on a very good level.
And I think this is sometimes very challenging because it's not only the culture between the different sizes of the company. So you have these small biotechs with a few people, highly specialized, and then you have the big structures of CROs. Also, trials are very often set up in different countries. And as we are in Europe, every country is proud of their own culture.
So language.
And language on top of that.
Yeah.
And non-native speakers, we always try to do our best in English, but let's face it, we are not native speakers. Yeah. So there is a lot of management that needs to be done. And I think sponsors, any biotech company that raises funds from investors should plan that upfront and tell the investor what they believe is really necessary to get done so the technical trial is at the end of the day successful. So basically it's not taking a Coke and popcorn and relax and sit down. It's hard work that needs to be done.
Yeah, it is hard work. And it's a lot. This is, it can be easily underestimated, the resources which are needed, the budget which is needed, and maybe also additional resources you have to add to your company. I have made experience that suddenly you company starts with a phase 2 clinical trial, having 35 sites involved in different countries, and they themselves had 2 people working in the finance department. And suddenly all these 2 people on top should check investigator invoices of 35 sites, and it was impossible. So, these are things you have to be also prepared to outsource clinical studies or to run a clinical trial and know what additional resources you might need besides the clinical people, besides the operational people.
So it's not only setting up one contract and then the work is done, unfortunately.
No, unfortunately not.
can we come up? I started writing with the pandemic 2 years ago, and I did a little bit of research in how to structure articles. And what goes always very well is these 3-step processes and this 3-step checklist is for sponsors. Can we turn it into a 3-step checklist for sponsors to keep studies on track? What needs to be done? What are the 3 most important steps in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, I think one is what we just talked about is establish a very well communication tool with the CRO, with the vendors. It can be through a governance charter, but really establish good communication with the CRO and very transparent. What we have experienced and what we always recommend is that a sponsor should be very clear on its expectations. Because it's often say, oh, yeah, this is a nice CRO. We give it to them. They're nice people. And they just hand over this study. But then suddenly things are happening. Nobody talked before about it. And it was obvious that these expectations were not very clearly communicated to the CRO, to the vendor. Then they do what they think is the right thing. And this could also be a very different opinion from both sides. So I think clear expectations at the beginning, clear developed roles and responsibilities would be the second part. And the third part is also what we just talked. Try to develop a good business intelligence, a dashboard, make sure that you have your KPIs in place and work with your KPIs for the study performance.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step-by-step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
So it's all about communication and motivations. It's clear management, and this needs senior and experienced people in the working at the sponsor. And this needs also then to be communicated in business plans to the investors and proper funding put in place so that these things can work. So now the big days come. So let's assume we did everything fine. We got millions on a bank account to conduct clinical trials, to do phase one and phase two studies. And the authorities, ethics committees say everything's fine, protocol well written, move forward, dose your first patient. What can go wrong then, in your opinion? What are the three main reasons why so many clinical trials fail?
Yeah, the majority of the clinical trials fail. It's because they fail in enrollment timelines. And this is, again, we go backwards, the selection of the sites. Do you have the right sites ready for you to start working? Are they ready for you to start working? And is the CRO ready and initiating immediately the sites after you have a positive approval by the authorities? Mm. So this can be, and this has a lot of influence. The study startup is a key activity for your clinical trial. If you have delays in study startup, for example, the sites are not initiated in time, they are not the right sites, because you did not perform the proper feasibility assessment beforehand. So the later a site starts to enroll patients, the later, of course, the patients will be ready for closing again. And so as much, so the preparation time is a key part in a clinical trial, to my opinion. And even though you have your positive approval, it doesn't mean that immediately the clinical trial starts. That means another planning and awareness and alertness that immediately all the activities are moving forward. And so, but then still, even if you're doing it, enrollment can lag behind your timelines. And this can result in, because maybe you have involved sites where suddenly they, when they see the final protocol, that they have only one or two patients who might fit into the protocol, but beforehand, they said, oh, in this indication, we have 15. So yeah, that is easy. And they don't mean it badly, because they still think, of course, they have the patient. But then suddenly the protocol, which they have not seen before, maybe in such a detailed level, shows that it's a reduced number. Mm-hmm. And so this goes back again in preparing while you are recruiting sites, really to look at what kind of patients do they have? Does they fit in the protocol? And to avoid having wrong sites. And or sometimes when you start your clinical trial or you change certain aspects in a clinical trial, this can be demotivating for sites, and they also do not enroll that many patients. Or other studies are faster in starting and enrolling patients which are in the same indication.
Let's stay a little bit with this enrollment perspective. What are, in your opinion, common factors this leads to a study requiring rescue when we look at enrollment? Let's dig a little bit deeper, because I think this is important. It's, in my opinion, a management work, but I think we should give them a little bit more room here.
Yes, I mean, when you start preparing your clinical trial or you talk with the CROs, you will see CROs will always recommend that you do a proper feasibility assessment. And I think this is key to a startup for a clinical study. You can have one part is that the sponsor themselves have done some good research in the incidence of the disease and where the patients could be found. And then, of course, the question is whether the protocol and the patients match. So this is one part. But then the other part is the feasibility assessment. And this is normally done very well by CROs. They know sites, they know the countries, they know the incidences of the diseases. And this is a point where you should not try to save money on it, because this is very important information, which could also redirect your clinical study. We have experiences very often that a sponsor had an idea of four or five countries, and the feasibility results had a different idea of countries, and we should add different countries also then. And this should be taken serious because the CROs have much more experience as a sponsor has. The sponsor is doing maybe one or two clinical trials, and the CRO is doing 50 clinical trials in this indication. And when they talk to their sites, it can be much more realistic on the enrollment, on the feasibility of the study in certain countries. And I think this is, I have the impression this is very often also underestimated, the use of the feasibility results, because there could be certain interests. Yeah, I would prefer to go to the Netherlands, to Belgium. It's much easier. I don't want to go to certain other countries. There might be problems with regulatory.
Here is to the third clip. Discovered the promising potential of psychedelic drugs to treat mental health issues. The global mental health crisis is affecting approximately 1 billion people worldwide. So basically, one of eight people has mental health issues. And some believe that this number is a gross underestimate. In this episode, Dr. Jonathan Sporn, he is the CEO of Gilgamesh Pharmaceutical, discusses the unmet medical need in mental health and the promising novel psychedelic drug development sector. Dr. Sporn, a board-certified psychiatrist and assistant professor at Columbia University, delves into the history of psychedelic drug development, investors in this promising area, and the different ingredients needed to structure a novel, game-changing drug development company. He also discusses the effectiveness of psychedelic drugs in treating mental health issues, the role of artificial intelligence in psychedelic drug development, and investment sentiment in the United States in developing novel innovations. Tune in to gain more insights into the potential of psychedelic drugs to help erase the mental burden in society. Did I get it right? This was the foundation, basically, of perception or neuroscience in your first company.
Right. And this is, you know, in perception, you know, Jim Morrison had the doors as from the doors of perception. I took the doors of perception. So I started perception and perception neuroscience. We started to get the trials planned and preclinical work going. And then as we were doing that, we needed to raise money. And a couple of different folks came along, including Christian Angermeyer, who was now enamored with psilocybin and psychedelics and wanted to build like the BridgeBio or Roivant kind of model and things. And he was him and George Goldsmith, who runs Compass, they were very intent on doing a deal to buy a controlling share in perception. So I negotiated a deal with them, so that perception got funded and, you know, moved forward. So that's how that, and now it's in phase two, development, which is, you know, happening in the US and Europe.
I mean, it's a big success. I mean, given that, I would say 99 out of 100 early stage biotech fail and don't move forward. So basically your company moved up to clinical phase two already with the compounds. It's really, congratulations. Yeah, it's great success. Right.
Yeah, thanks. No, we have to, you know, I think it's, there's a very high probability of success for that compound, given the data. And I think it'd be very surprising if it doesn't work.
Which indication does Atai focus with your compounds now?
It's being developed for treatment-resistant depression. And I think it could, would be effective for pretty much any kind of depression or an anxiety disorder and substance abuse disorders too. Mm. So it has a pretty broad spectrum of activity, and there's strong intellectual property. So it's a pretty good program. And now, ironically, they brought people from Johnson & Johnson in to run it.
So the circle is closed now. So it's basically Johnson & Johnson back.
Johnson & Johnson who were like screaming at them, like, why aren't you talking to Sporn about licensing our ketamine? And they were like, shut up. Don't ever.
That's a funny part of the story. Let me ask you one question. I'm curious. I mean, usually here in Austria or in Europe, the dream of scientists who got the entrepreneurial spark, found a company, sell a company, and the dream usually ends with they live happily ever after on the islands with 10 Teslas and nice houses and just retire and enjoy life. You decided to found another company. Why? Why did you say there is something that needs to be done?
Christian's right. Mental health problems are 100%. You see, I don't see what I do generally as work. So it's extremely interesting and fun. So like I think, you know, I don't know what I would, you know, do on the island after I drove the Tesla around a few times, you know. I think that, so what, you know, I mean, honestly, what happened was I stayed on at Perception as the chief scientific officer, but it just didn't feel like the right fit for me. Unless they were going to really take Perception and make it into a larger enterprise, but, you know, it was really a single product company. And so the best use of my ability wasn't really running, you know, those early stage, you know, projects, you know, for that one molecule, at that point. So I think I didn't stay that long there after that. And then I had through, you know, sort of again, back to my Johnson & Johnson roots, one of my close friends was the head of sort of licensing stuff for Johnson & Johnson for neuroscience. And he brought me to his lake house north of New York with this young medicinal chemist who, and he brought me because the chemist was interested in a molecule called thioneptine, which is an antidepressant in Europe. It doesn't exist in the US. Mm-hmm. It was a Servier molecule, and he was making new salts or new forms of thioneptine, and this guy knew that at J&J I had been instrumental in getting J&J to make new salts of thioneptine and tried to get them to develop it. To no avail. They were going to start a company to do it, and then they lost interest somehow along the way. Another big company story. And so they brought me to meet him, and then we stayed in touch. And then when I realized that I was going to leave Perception, I called him up and said, "We're starting a company." And he had already also started a company that he also now has sold to Atai, to Christian's folks. And called Cures with a K. And so I said, we're going to start a company and we're going to do what I think was not being done in the psychedelic space, which was to develop novel drugs with IP on the chemical matter that were going to really innovate the space, as opposed to psilocybin's a great drug, so why don't we develop it even though it's a generic drug? Or MDMA is a great drug, but it's a generic drug. There's not much innovation there. There's just, you know, pushing things through the system. And then, of course, you know, pharma's not interested in those things because they can't protect them for their investment. So I had this vision that we would take what we knew scientifically. Also, I realized that these chemists were really into psychedelics. And so they knew every compound that had been made and tried by people anecdotally. So like the great chemist, Sasha Shulgin, who, you know, used to work with the DEA, and then they and then he published, his books, his sort of kind of recipe books on how to make psychedelics, and they, you know, parted ways with him. But he had made, you know, changed atom, you know, by atom, these psychedelic drugs, and then tried hundreds of them himself. And so he was sort of the, you know, the great sort of father of the psychedelic, you know, chemistry area. And so they knew every single molecule that Shastrilgan, what he had said about them. And also, you know, there's on the web, there's so many people with trip reports reporting on their, you know, all these psychonauts reporting on their experience with psychedelic drugs. So I realized these guys knew everything about this. And they were also really good academic, you know, experienced chemists. And Andrew Prugel, my partner, was, you know, very entrepreneurial. So I said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take molecules of different kinds, and we're going to then look at them, and then we're going to say, what could be better? And so, as an example, even though R-ketamine is this drug and I think is, you know, making great progress, we were like, well, it's good, but if it was a pill, it would be even better. So can we design a molecule that will have, you know, where the properties of it will be, commensurate with R-ketamine, but it's a new molecule and it's different because it's a pill. Because ketamine, you can't really use very readily as a pill because your liver chops it up fast in a variable way. So it's the first pass metabolism problem. So that's an example where we realize, like, you know, we can likely do that fairly easily.
Given you have the right team. So I think chemistry is not that easy.
Oh, no, right. But for the right chemists with the right ideas, it wasn't that hard. And what was interesting was that in the space, all the people interested in ketamine were mostly clinicians and not chemists. So they were looking at ketamine, R-ketamine, metabolites, but they weren't thinking about making new molecules. They didn't know how to do that. This really hadn't caught the attention yet of too much of big pharma. And J&J was already pot committed with S-ketamine. So we realized we could do that. And then we just went down the line. We were like, okay, well, you know, for example, DMT, which is, you know, one of the active components of ayahuasca, you know, which is this, you know, Peruvian, you know, concoction that people make that's very psychedelic, but people vape DMT, but it only lasts about 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And so we thought, well, DMT is a great drug, but it's so fast, it's so short acting. We weren't sure that was long enough to really be fully therapeutic. And on the other hand, things like psilocybin or LSD last, you know, 4, 6, 8 hours. And that's really hard on, you know, our healthcare system, right? Like, how do you, you know, have people sitting around for 6 hours in your clinic, you know? So we decided that what we'd like is a molecule that maybe lasted, that was like DMT, but lasted about an hour. And also DMT has some serotonin releasing properties, which is partly what MDMA does. So it gives you this sort of warm, emotional, connected feeling. So we realized that we could have a molecule that was a little bit like psilocybin, but also a little bit like MDMA, and lasted about an hour. So we designed a molecule with those properties, and that's another example where now we think it's a hypothesis that will have about the right characteristics therapeutically for, you know, neuropsychiatric kind of conditions. This has sort of been now an iterative process. That there's this tremendous amount of this stuff going on in the company. You know, another example is we thought, well, you know, people love microdosing. But the problem with microdosing is, you know, you're taking, say, a tenth or 2/10 of a dose of a full psychedelic dose of, say, LSD. But the problem is that you know, you don't want to send your grandmother home with a big bottle of LSD and tell her to take one, because she might, depending on the grandmother, take more than that. And so, you know, it has problems as a take home medicine because of the potential for it to be, abused or not adhered to dose wise. So
we are almost through with this review of 2022 and are coming to the fourth clip, revolutionizing healthcare, the role of virtual reality in diagnosing neurological diseases. Wearable devices like virtual reality headsets are increasingly used for diagnostic purposes in the healthcare industry. In this podcast episode, Adrian Brodesser, CEO of Soma Reality, a company specializing in developing VR devices for diagnostic purposes, joins to discuss the use of VR in diagnosing neurological diseases. Through digital biomarkers based on eye tracking, VR provides doctors with new tools to understand and treat conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. In the episode, Brodesser also covers the challenges of entrepreneurship and the potential for VR in healthcare and sports. As VR technology continues to advance, it has the potential to revolutionize the way we approach diagnosis and treatment for a variety of conditions. Let's dig a little bit deeper into what that means, understanding the user better and how we can make use of that in therapy and diagnostics. The solutions before we met that I saw on the market were, when it came to understanding the user better, but pretty much you can move a cursor in a game from left to right, and that's pretty much it. What does it mean, understanding the user better?
So there, of course, that's a great question. There's a variety of different approaches of understanding the user, also depending on the outcome that you want. It's quite funny always when I tell people what we do, the first thing they ask is, okay, so you're in marketing. That's always the first, because of course, that is where, you know, if you're not in that field, you always feel, okay, understanding people, it's always about understanding why or why not they're buying a product. Fair enough.
It's funny because with virtual reality, you can send the user through a grocery store and then make the companies aware where they are looking positioned there. This is not what you're doing.
No, this is not what we're doing, but this is what we could do. So with great power comes great responsibility. this is exactly what we could do with our technology. To make it concrete, So we are utilizing eye tracking. We're utilizing pupil dilation, small eye movements to really gain insight about the cognitive state of the user. Our first product, our first algorithm is cognitive load, which basically describes the capacity of your working memory. While you're performing a task, we always need our working memory active. And it's, you know, the capacity is like a range. Depending how difficult the task is, depending how many tasks you do at the same time, this capacity, of course, is filled or is, quite easy to do. And so with that information, what we can do is a variety of things. Maybe I'll give the two most exciting ones. Mm-hmm. The first one is measuring attention. So to come back to the marketing approach, this would be exactly this. We're able to not only measure gaze tracking, so where is the person looking, but we're able to combine it with when the person is looking at a certain spot in, for example, the digital environment. We're also able to exactly tell, was he or she actually processing information while he or she was looking at the spot, or was it, you know, just staring point blank at that specific spot, which of course has a variety of like medical insights that you can derive from that and much, much more. The other part that is very exciting is cognitive load is also very much linked to learning state. So when I mentioned at the beginning the virtual reality medical trainings, integrating cognitive load measurements in these virtual reality trainings really enables us to better understand are there certain steps in that training process that really lead to cognitive overload, meaning that this individual really struggles with the current state of the training process, which of course is very valuable to then deep dive with, for example, an expert to really understand what the struggles are.
What are the commercial applications?
So commercial applications. A variety of commercial applications. I think one of the most exciting ones, I can give you two examples. The first one is also in the field of medicine, where we work with the company Intuitive. They have their own research grant structure that we recently won, where we thank you very much. Where we now are integrating our cognitive load algorithm to really measure gaze and cognitive load of the console surgeon. So I don't know if you've ever seen a Da Vinci robot system really in place, but there's always this one surgeon who is controlling the robot, and most of the time he's sitting in one corner of the room. They basically communicate, the surgeon communicates with the rest of the team via voice, or really with, communicating. There's a screen for the OR team that basically visualizes what the robot is seeing inside the patient. And so with our technology, we're now measuring gaze and cognitive load in order to really find out, are these visualizations that we can provide additionally to the communication layer that they're currently using, so meaning voice, can we actually enhance the team dynamic leading to less errors? So this is one of the examples. Another example is with the company Lufthansa, where we actually use cognitive load to gain insights about the pilot during the training. So these pilots are using virtual reality, which is, I believe, very, very interesting since it's not my field. They are using virtual reality for training for the simulator. The simulator is actually very, very expensive, like 70 million. 1 hour in the simulator is, very expensive as well. And so they're using VR in order to be ready once they enter the simulator. And we use virtual reality together with them and cognitive load measurements to really prepare them and measure where are certain steps in the procedure that we really need to take a closer look at before they enter the simulator.
Can you explain it a little bit more in detail, the case with Lufthansa? What does it mean that you evaluate which steps in the procedure are necessary before they enter the simulator?
So these simulators, so they're the big simulators, 70 million upwards, so very expensive, they run 23/7. So we always like to say 23 hours is for training, the last hour is for cleaning. So they're like fully booked. So these technologies that we are now, utilizing together with them, virtual reality really is used in order to train them before, so make them comfortable with the whole simulator environment. And we're using virtual reality so that they're ready once they enter the simulator, that they already have figured everything out and they can use the time in the simulator as effective as possible. Now, with our technology, so eye tracking and cognitive load measurements, we can now really say, okay, while the person, while the pilot is training in VR, preparing himself for the real simulator, we really can see, is there a step during the process where we can really see his or her cognitive load is really, spiking because there is mental overload, because he or she is really overwhelmed with some stage of the progress. And so with that insight, we then, of course, can use that insight to really prepare him or her to, that specific stage of the process, really train that specific part before they enter the simulator.
So to rephrase it into my world, so basically, the simulators are very expensive. And when you book 1 hour, which I believe the pilots probably need for keeping their license. So they probably need some trainings there. It's not that you can say, okay, come half an hour later because I was stuck in a traffic jam and start preparing then half an hour later and they have the simulator as long as they want it. So it's really on the point. You need to be there. You need to be on the point. You need to be ready. You need to be in the procedure and running through your training, and then you get probably points or something, and you can keep your license and keep on flying with commercial airlines. This is one value proposition that you help them. So basically, it's like a warm-up with your virtual reality classes. And the second thing that you can provide, showing the pilot the weak points. So you say, okay, at this point, you were not really paying attention. Is that the right understanding?
Yes. So, of course, that is really the first step. Mm-hmm. So the end solution that we're now researching together with them is actually an attention recommender system. And of course, I don't want to go in too much details because it will get probably too complicated. But basically, you know, since aviation has like these highly standardized processes, which of course is not yet happening in medicine, but that's another topic. And we can also jump into that as well if you want.
Sure.
So we have like this very standardized process during the simulation. And so if we now measure, you know, which of the certain parameters during the virtual reality training, so before the simulator, are overstimulating or overloading, we then of course can have a very detailed discussion why this is overloading. How do we actually make it, adapt the training to your needs so that you are prepared for when you actually enter the simulator? And now in the next stage, these systems would actually be so smart that they understand where you're currently struggling and would be able to provide you with visual cues about the next step that he or she needs to take in the virtual environment. So this is the direction that, you know, these technologies go.
So it's basically assisting them in training. Isn't that useful for other industries? I mean, you said healthcare before, and I'm not an expert in aviation, so it's... you said that they are highly standardized, and I translated it into my world, like other industries are not highly standardized. Not being an expert in aviation, I would say healthcare also, the closer it is to the patient. You mentioned intuitive surgical, for example. I always thought that surgeries are also highly standardized processes, how people walk in, what they need to do before they can do the procedure on the patient, that the procedure on the patient is highly standardized. Of course, always something can happen in the procedure. No patient is the same, but I always thought also surgeons have standardized procedures. Is that the wrong understanding that I got?
No, that is definitely not the wrong understanding, but I think you mentioned the key point. Every patient is different, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think this is really the key part. The cockpit of a certain airplane will always be the same. The buttons are always on the exact same position. Of course, that is something we don't have in healthcare. So the level of standardization is just really, there's still a huge gap.
And can you use your training environment also for that industry, for healthcare? So that basically you also tell people when they run through the procedure where they have their weak spots?
Yeah, definitely. So that is something we also do. So, for example, together with the Medical University of Vienna, we are doing exactly what we are doing with Lufthansa, but just in a medical setting. So exactly the same value proposition.
I mean, just for brainstorming, let's get a little bit creative. We were talking about creativity in the beginning. Sports, for example, I very often saw people skiing downhill races, that they just stood there running in their mind through the race. Is that not something that you can automate with virtual reality or enhance with virtual reality classes and giving them more information about their behavior during the downhill race, the simulated downhill race?
I'm not a downhill expert, but definitely. So I can give you an example that we also think is very promising, which is actually gaze training. Mm-hmm. So what I mean is, since you are basically in VR involved in this digital cutoff environment, thinking about downhill, and again, I've never done downhill before, but you could have a for example, let's keep it simple, a video capture of the path downwards. And you could actually use training methods to train when should the person, the downhill biker, I guess, when should he or she actually look at that specific part. So, you know, what you mentioned, what these people are currently doing all in their heads with just standing and saying, okay, left, right, you could actually have that as like a mobile training laboratory where you put it on, you visually really go down the hill, and then there's visual cues, now look here, because you, of course, now the turn is coming in 5 meters. That's everything that you could measure, yes, and of course then train.
And here is the final clip of the highlights episode of 2022, the role of biophysics in drug development and drug discovery with Dr. Thomas Schubert of TwoBind. Biophysics plays a crucial role in the pharmaceutical industry, particularly in drug development and drug discovery. In this episode, Dr. Thomas Schubert, CEO of TwoBind, a provider of biophysical outsourcing solutions for the pharmaceutical industry, discusses the role of biophysics in drug development and the importance of outsourcing in the industry. Biophysics, which combines the principles of physics, chemistry, and mathematics to understand biological systems, can be used to design and develop new drugs that target specific molecules and biological processes. Dr. Schubert also shares insights into the technologies and competition in the biophysics world and highlights some of TwoBind's success stories in this field. He also discusses the evolution of biophysics in drug development over the past decade and the role of biophysics in antibody research and development. Tune in to learn more about how biophysics drives innovation in the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, the traditional business models that I learned at university and in a commercial school before was find customers first. And when you want to grow your business, then you talk to investors. This new world like we have now where investors invest in startups without any business model was quite unusual in Europe, at least in the 90s or in the 80s of last century. So it's a smart move basically to find customers. Let's get a little bit into investigative podcasting. you mentioned there were for certain reasons biophysics was not so important 10 years ago, and its importance increased in drug development and drug discovery over the last 10 years. Why was it not important, and why did the importance increase? Two questions.
Yeah. So first of all, one has to say that the way of developing drugs and discovery of drugs has been changed since the last years. So 10 years before, a lot of the targets that were out there and were worked on were enzymatic targets, which had a clear activity that you can read out with biochemical approaches. A biochemical approach is different to a biophysical approach, since you use an activity that the protein has to generate a signal that you can read out. The biophysics is more interested in the direct interaction rather than the activity. And so a lot of the efforts were done, first of all, on biochemical approaches. So HTS campaigns, meaning high throughput screening, was done on a complete different, let's say, platform, right? It is a different life science part. And biophysics was only this little tiny little piece when you had your compound and then you saw an activity, and then it's just like this confirmation thing. Like, will you please confirm that this one thing is doing something? So it was a minor part, let's call. Of course, I'm a little bit over-exaggerating, but you know my...
But it's always good for podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to make it a like... understandable
and fun. Science can be fun as well.
So. Yeah, of course. And yeah, sure. I mean, biophysics also played a role in the past, but nowadays, it is, for example, the case that hard to drug targets in a cell, they cannot be read out with a biochemical approach. There's no other way than a direct binding event. So you need, when you want to develop and discover a drug, you need to find a binder which binds to the protein or the RNA, whatever target you're interested in. And since there's no biochemical approach, you need biophysics. You need to see the interaction. You need to understand how fast this goes on and off and what the affinity is of the two. And therefore, the attention that is now for biophysics has increased. And in addition, not just the target side. So it's not just new protein types and even a complete new field. The RNA as a target. So it's really going away from the protein towards an RNA as a direct target for a small molecule. Mm-hmm. For example, you want to establish a certain structure in an RNA or disrupt the structure. And as a consequence of that, the cell has, you know, is somehow modified, whatever aspect of a cell you want to modify. So this was not there 10 years before. This is a relatively new approach, and the complete approach heavily depending on biophysical approaches. And so a complete new field emerged even that was not present at 10 years. And then in addition, if you always have two molecules for a drug development, the target and the drug. Mm-hmm. And before it was always like small molecules, some 300, 400, 500 Dalton in size, had certain rules to fulfill. And basically you were constantly screening things and making efforts if the cell is somehow affected. Nowadays, it's not just this one single small molecule that is in focus. Now complete new entities come along, for example, proteins. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this new class of molecules has a complete different approach than a classical inhibitor. So it's not an inhibitor. So a PROTAC is a combination of two small molecules, which are linked with a linker. And the idea is to bring a protein of interest in the close proximity of an enzyme that tells the cell to degrade that protein. So mm-hmm. the cell is told to get rid of this one specific protein. This complete concept was not present 10 years ago. And again, we're not talking about an activity. You need another readout, and binding is one of the interactions, or one interaction is one of those things that you can read out with biophysics. So a long story short, many different changes in the environment of drug discovery have come along in the last 10 years, and all of them kind of push biophysics. And that is the reason why now biophysics as the application, but also the outsourcing market is increasing constantly. And of course, for us, that is something very nice. And we were happy to realize that new entities come along, new targets, new things that we can address. And that allowed us to build also our portfolio to serve the customer in the best way.
That's great. That's great to hear that drug discovery is changing, and it's getting, I think it's also getting more and more complex, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So this classical paradigm, you have one protein, you tackle that protein, everything is solved. No. So nowadays it's really a systematic approach. You need to consider a lot of more things. Honestly, the very low hanging fruits are already gone. And now it's really, they're absolutely fascinating concepts out there. Again, we're in a lucky position because, sometimes, let's say when challenging things happen, it is sometimes good to start with an outsourcing approach, giving an expert a first try and then integrating things into own labs. And therefore, we get in touch with a lot of state of the art or really at the edge ideas. And that is what is really fun here. So we are confronted with projects which are super innovative and super challenging. But that's the fun. That's really cool.
Is your position, what are you doing with antibodies? Is this also a part of your business?
Yeah. Let's make it a little bit different. So biophysics can serve to answer two types of questions. One type of question is related to the interaction of two molecules, A and B. So they bind, they bind fast and slow, or they bind strong, or they are two of these and just one of those, and so on. So it's binding parameters, first question. And the second question is, for example, for antibodies, it's very relevant to stabilize an antibody. Mm-hmm. If you imagine you have a drug, and it's in a syringe, and you want to push it into an arm of a patient to cure the patient, the antibody has to be very stable in there, because the vessel or the syringe or whatever, the solution has to be stored somewhere 4 degrees or whatever in a liquid formulation. And this is something that you can really nicely address with biophysics. So we serve not just those guys from the drug discovery area with the interaction analysis type of things, but we also work a lot on antibodies and determine the optimal storage conditions of an antibody. Let's make it in simple words. A very important point as well, but very different. Because the one thing is very early, R&D, super, sometimes very, okay, wow, that is a cool concept. It's fascinating. Let's think about it first. And finding, the formulation of a well-established antibody, which is already super characterized, is a complete different aspect of what we do here.
So we can also add value to established technology that is already on the market, make it better, improve it, understand it better. So basically you look in detail on how things work.
Yeah, exactly. As mentioned before, we use the physics phenomena to really check out what's the exact mechanism of something. And I think there are so many applications, and we're so happy to be at that point, because we made absolutely fascinating measurements for example, for in vitro diagnostic guys, where we helped to develop tests for an allergen in milk, or an allergen in apple juice or something. So this is really fascinating. This can also be solved with biophysics. So it's a very universal approach, actually, biophysics.
One term came across my table in the last 2 to 4 years. It's ADCs, antibody drug conjugates. Does biophysics also play a role in that?
Yeah, for sure.
which role? So next question, which role?
Yeah. And so
I'm not satisfied with for sure.
For those guys who might not know ADC, so it's basically the idea is that an antibody, which is a molecule that can bind to a certain target structure, so it recognizes a certain structure, for example, on a cell, for example, on a cancer cell, let's call it. There's a cancer cell, and the surface on the cancer cell has certain structure, certain function, and an antibody is a binding molecule which recognizes the cancer cell, for example, but discriminates native cell. And of course, the idea is, if I add a payload to the antibody which is toxic, then I can toxidate the unwanted cell in a cancer, and leave the native environment untouched. So this is an ADC. And of course, this payload or warhead, a lot of people call this warhead, has to be attached to the protein, so to the antibody via chemical linking. And of course, that chemical linking is a modification of the original protein, right? And again, you need to understand, does that influence the antibody or not? Is it still doing what it should do? Is it still binding to the target? Is it still, stable? Does it fall apart? Is it suddenly, does it tend to aggregate? Does it go out of the aqueous solution? And is then, of course, not a drug anymore? These things we can also work on, yeah.
So we can really measure it and get more details on that. I mean, I find the concept very interesting. It always reminds me a little bit on about warfare. It's like an aircraft. So you put a payload, missiles on an aircraft, and then you send the aircraft into the air, which basically in ADC terms is into the body. And they're always at a hard time to understand. I mean, how do you guarantee that the payload is released at the point of action where it's intended and not somewhere else in the body? How can you measure that?
Yeah.
When it's in the biological system, we think it's easy in the lab, so to say, okay, this happens and that happens, but a body is different. How do you measure that in a body?
First of all, I'm not really familiar with the body. that's maybe also something in general, the biophysics guys, we don't really work with a living cell, and we don't have that. We are completely in vitro guys. But I know that there are phenotypic readouts where you can realize if a cell is reacting on that antibody, if it changes its shape, if it suffers, and you can see that when a cell changes its shape or even dies. So you can see that. Honestly, how they measure this in a living body, I have to admit, I have no clue.
So your work is basically in vitro. So it's basically on the lab bench before clinical development.
Exactly. Correct. Absolutely.
Where is your company positioned in the value chain? Let's talk about your organization. And to close this episode of the Beginner's Mind podcast, I want to give a brief outlook on the topic, what the future holds for the podcast. As we start now into 2023, I can't help but feel excited about what the future holds for our podcast. In the coming year, my team and I have set some ambitious goals to help grow and expand the podcast even further. One of our main objectives is to transform the podcast into a video show, which will provide a more effective platform for promoting the brands, science, entrepreneurship, investing, and voices of our speakers. We are actively seeking speakers who can share important information on holistic health, preventive medicine and well-being, pharma and health tech, artificial intelligence, climate change, and of course, entrepreneurship and investing, which is dear to my heart. Our other goals for 2023 include doubling our organic reach on social media, creating more media partnerships to further increase the reach of the brand and voices of our speakers, and also increasing our cash flows to support the social media marketing of our partners' brands. That's why I'm actively looking for additional partners who help bringing the quality of the show to the next level. The raised funds will be used to improve the production quality of the show. I will invest them in marketing on social media and also to further develop and increase the podcast team. We also aim to produce 50 more episodes featuring engaging speakers and get the message out into the market. While there will certainly be challenges ahead, I am confident that with hard work and determination, we will be able to achieve these goals and positively impact our community. Have a fantastic new year. See you soon on the show.